everyone, and welcome to Terror Tea. I'm your host, Tara, and today we are going to be covering 2000's Scream 3. I'm going to go ahead and go on record as saying this is my least favorite Scream. This episode is so damn delayed because I did not want to watch it. But I have to cover them all, so here we are. Scream 3 originally came out on February 4th of 2000. This movie had a very troubled production, with not having Neve Campbell the entire time, to needing to bring in Aaron Kruger, needing a complete rewrite due to Columbine. Just Scream 3 is a bit of a mess, and it truly only has a few redeeming qualities. So let's just jump into it. The movie begins with a shot of the Hollywood sign. There's been an accident on the highway, so traffic is completely stuck. Cotton Weary's on the phone talking to someone about how he's ruining his reputation by doing a cheesy cameo in a slasher. He said they could have at least written him a decent part because he lived through the damn thing. His cell starts ringing. He's been on a car phone, and it's a wrong number. The woman on the phone says she knows his voice and that he sounds like Cotton Weary. She tells him he has a sexy voice. He thanks her. He ends up hanging up the car phone and goes back to his cell asking if she's a big 100% Cotton fan. This is his TV show that he has. He asks who she is, and the girl says that he's naughty and asks what his girlfriend would think. Cotton asks if, who says I have a girlfriend, and the voice changes to Ghostface, saying that he's right outside her bathroom door. He compliments her voice, and we see someone sneaking into the bathroom at Cotton's house. Ghostface says that she's a step up from Maureen Prescott and wants to play a game. He asks Cotton where Sydney is, and of course he's like, how the hell would I know? He threatens Ghostface, who says that's the wrong answer, and hangs up. Cotton tries to get out of traffic, hits a car, and ends up being able to speed away. Christine gets out of the shower, and Cotton tries calling her while driving erratically. She goes to the bedroom, drops her towel, and when she does, we see that the phone lines are cut. Cotton tries calling 911, but because of the accidents and all that, he's basically left on hold. Christine gets dressed when the radio turns on in Cotton's office. She thinks it's him, so she goes to see where he's at. Of course, he's not there, so she turns off the music and says that she doesn't like playing his stab games. My first thought was, gross. Cotton is twisted enough to play stab games. She hears a door opening, yells out, and we hear Cotton's voice saying that she won't believe what happened to him. Ghostface then comes out with a knife and chases after her. She trips and falls from walking all over the house with wet feet from the shower. She locks herself in his office, and his voice calls out trying to apologize to her. He said he's just trying to take the game to the next level, and she asks what game. He says ripping her insides out and starts trying to stab through the door. The real Cotton arrives and sees the front door open. We hear Cotton on the TV doing a report on road rage. Cotton goes all over the house trying to find Christine. He grabs a fire poker and then sees the stab marks in the door to his office. He hears a noise behind the door and busts open. Christine hits him in the head with a golf club and he asks what's going on. She calls him he's crazy. He's trying to get her to come to him and put the golf club down. He starts walking towards her. He sees Ghostface behind her because they basically switched spots, and now she's standing in front of the doorway. And he's trying to get her away, but she ends up smacking him in the head with the golf club. And Ghostface stabs Christine in the back and then goes after Cotton. Cotton knocks a bookshelf down on Ghostface, but he ends up getting away and stabs him in the chest. He tells Cotton with his own voice in this stupid-ass voice changer that he has to tell him where Sydney was. But because he didn't, now he loses. He stabs him in the face, and we get our title card. We see the California hills, we hear Sydney's lament, and it's Sydney walking her dog Cherokee, and she locks up the gate to her property, and she has a lock and a pin pad. She goes inside, and we see her doing the same thing, so she's very secure and secluded. She goes to her computer, where we see the California Women's Crisis Counseling binder. She calls in, saying it's Laura in Monterey, and she asks to be patched in. She's basically working from home as a counselor. We cut to Gail, who's giving a speech, I'm assuming at a college or something. She says that being the best is being willing to do whatever it takes and whatever the others won't. She says it's, being willing to be hated. So someone in the crowd says, should we be willing to cut each other's throats because that's what you did? Gail doesn't get to answer any questions or anything because the meeting is cut short. She leaves, and Mark Kincaid is there to ask about Cotton. He tells her that he is sharing this with her because she's the Woodsboro authority and she knew Cotton, but threatens to arrest her if she tells anyone. the photos of Maureen Prescott. We cut back to Sydney where there's a news report about Cotton's death. Sydney is visibly shaken. We cut back to Sunrise Studio. Cotton was complaining about his part as if it was like a brand new like cameo, but he's on the posters and everyone is talking about how he's already filmed his part. So like, what is he complaining about if it's already been done? This is just one incident of sloppy writing that is consistent throughout this movie. We see reporters trying to get into the studio and everything's shut down. The director, Roman, and studio execs are talking with John Milton, who's the head of the studio, about violence in cinemas. Roman says that Cotton was their idea, and Milton asks the officers if they think it had anything to do with the movie.
Detectives, there's no reason to presume that Cotton's death had anything to do with this movie, is there?
He was making a movie called Stab. He was stabbed.
We see in front of a mock-up of Stu's house, the cast is talking about why Cotton was murdered. Tyson says it was likely a fan pissed off that they killed Randy and stabbed too. Tom asks if that makes him next. Tom's playing Dewey. Tyson says that he is his own character, and Sarah goes, yeah, Ricky, who works in the video store. Tyson's like, no, it's an homage. Tom asks if the killer could be Sydney. He mentions how she's basically disappeared. Angelina, who is the new Sydney, comments that she's starting to see why Tori Spelling and David Schwimmer didn't want to come back. They were playing Dewey and Sydney, respectively. Sarah says they aren't in any danger, and Tyson references that her character says the exact same thing in the script. Angelina says that maybe it's just not meant to be. Tom says that she won a talent search for the new Sydney and beat out 50,000 other girls, so she's gonna be praying it continues. She says she is, but not at the expense of others and their lives. Gail arrives at the studio and sees that they've recreated Woodsboro. She gets her purse camera ready and Jennifer Jolie spots her. She says that she understands, you know, you've never returned my calls, but after two movies, I feel like I'm in your mind. Of course, Gail's like, oh, that explains my constant headaches. Jennifer apologizes for 60 Minutes 2 not working out, but says that Total Entertainment is a good fallback. Gail says that she's sorry it didn't work out with Brad Pitt, but being single, that's a good fallback. And of course, I love the character names because you've got Jennifer Jolie, who is Jolie, Angelina Jolie. Brad Pitt is her ex-husband, whose ex-wife was Jennifer Aniston, who worked with Courtney Cox on Friends. And then Angelina Tyler, Angelina Jolie. Like, I just feel like all the names kind of go together. And it's all references to other people in Hollywood, which I find interesting. Later on, when we get to like the fake names for like Rena Reynolds, Judy Jurgenstein, and all that, I think it's very stupid. And I originally, in the script that I'm gonna talk about later, because there is a very early draft that I'm gonna go over in detail later. It talks about how Gail's like Maureen would have been Maureen Reynolds, meaning that her last name is not Roberts, like we find out in, well, I get you find out in this maybe that it's Roberts, but they really talk about it in 4, obviously, because Jill's last name is Roberts. But it makes sense that she would go by Rena Reynolds if her name was Maureen Reynolds before she married Neil Prescott. And it never crossed my mind that Maureen and Rena, like, that's where she got that from. I thought it was a really fucking weird name. But now it makes sense. Anyways, enough of that tangent. So Jennifer says that being single gives her more time for her work. Gail turns, and there's Dewey looking for Jennifer. Dewey's like, oh, surprise, surprise, someone dies. Gail comes running. Jennifer tells her that Dewey has really helped her figure out the true Gail. And of course, there's comments about finding that sad, lonely girl inside, which Gail is like, what the fuck? Gail says that she thought he was in Woodsboro, and he tells her that he is surprised that she thought of him at all, but that he needs to get to work. He's the technical advisor on the film. And it's in these scenes that I notice there is a weird filter on this movie. Yes, Scream 4 takes the cake for shitty filters on these movies, but Scream 3 has this weird, like, micro dot filter where everybody is covered in these little black dots, and I never noticed it until my most recent watching. It is almost as distracting as the Scream 4 filter, I will say. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. So I'm sorry. Gail tells Dewey about the photos that are being found at the crime scenes. He already knows. She asks about Sydney, and he tells her that she doesn't need her or her camera in her life. And Gail's like, do you see a camera anywhere? And he gestures to her purse that he bought for her. So yeah, he does know there's a camera. So then Milton sees Gail and is like, nope, you gotta get out. She's gone. And before she tries to say, like, I'm here with the detectives and all this. And in the early draft, she is much more involved. Like, Kincaid brings her everywhere with him. So she is more involved with the police. Like, it seems almost like a throwaway now because they cut so much of that out. There's also a studio tour, which we get some of our cameos, one of which is Wes Craven's cameo. He's a tourist, so look for him. We cut back to Sydney's, and her dad Neil is there helping her put away groceries, saying, you know, Cotton's death isn't about us. Sydney asks if he thinks about Maureen, and she asks why she had so many secrets. Neil tells Sydney that he's worried about her and that maybe it's time for her to come home. She says, you know, the psychos can't kill what they can't find. A little bit later, Sydney's asleep on the couch. It starts getting real stupid. We see ghost Maureen Prescott walking through Sydney's backyard, which of course has fog and it's supposed to look real spooky. And Wes Craven even said he wasn't sure about doing this scene because of course he's known as the dream killer guy because of Nightmare on Elm Street, and so he wasn't sure he wanted this in the film. But whatever, it's here. So she's like trying to get her attention. She has her bloody hands, she's touching the window, and she's telling her that everything she touches dies. She calls her a poison, saying, you know, you're just like me. She slides down the window, and when Sydney walks over to it, Ghostface jumps up, breaks the window, but then Sydney wakes up, and of course, none of that actually happened. It was all a dream sequence. We cut back to the studio where Sarah has arrived. There's a big ghost face mask that's hung up on the wall and it's green. So like I said in my last episode, I'm thinking that the stabbed ghost face may glow in the dark or something because it doesn't really look green on the brief clips we see in Scream 2. And in Scream 4, we do see more ghost face in Stab, and it doesn't look green either. So I don't know if it glows in the dark or what. Like, I don't know why everything's green. But whatever. So Sarah's looking for Roman. She says, you know, I need a new agent. This is ridiculous. She's walking to the studio when we hear someone. Tyson jumps out, and he's got blood all over him and scissors through his head. Turns out they're doing a makeup test. She asks if he's seen Roman because he's supposed to meet her because it's important. He's like, everything to Roman is important. Everyone's went home. So Sarah goes to his office to wait and she sees a trophy. She picks it up, but drops it when the phone rings and the head of the little statue breaks off. She answers the phone and it's Roman saying that he's stuck in traffic on the highway. He wants to talk about her character. She's like, why? I'm in two scenes. And she talks about she's not happy that she's 35 playing a 21-year-old or that she has to die naked. Roman wants to run lines, so they start and realize that the lines don't match up. So she starts yelling, has there been another goddamn rewrite? And it is so distracting in this scene because of the way Jenny McCarthy says, has there been another goddamn rewrite? Because she does this weird thing with her mouth. Like, I saw it the first time I watched this movie and it distracts the shit out of me every time I see it, so I had to mention it. So she's, you know, there's been another rewrite. How are we supposed to learn our lines if there's a new script every 15 minutes? Which is really what they were going through during the movie because they were constantly getting pages and the script was changing. So Roman tells her that it's a new movie. The voice changes to Ghostface saying, you know, Sarah gets stuck like a fucking pig. So she leaves. She sees someone walking up. It's actually just a security guard trying to lock up for the night. Of course, she doesn't realize that. So she goes and hides in what ends up being like the costume closet, the prop closet. There's a ton of Ghostface costumes. She goes and hides on a rack that they're all sitting on. When suddenly we realize one of them is actually Ghostface, and he ends up pulling out his knife, pushes the cart through the door. She falls out of the cart. She goes to grab a knife to stab him, but they're all props. And he punches her in the face, stabs her in the back, and shoves her through the glass window that's in the door. So she's just kind of like hanging there. It only looks like he stabs her once, but somehow she has blood all over her face. And she's, you know, dead. So Dewey and Gale are now at a restaurant, and she tells him that the police came to her. She didn't go to them. She's not here to be sensationalist. And he's like, why? And she's like, because I wrote the books. I wrote the definitive Woodsboro novels. Like, that's her big thing. He accuses her of not being able to wait to write another one. And she's like, why did you leave Woodsboro? You said that was the only place that was real. And she's like, now you're here and not with me. And she's like, I took care of you. I waited till you were well. But 1 year in Woodsboro is like 7 everywhere else. He comments about her traveling the globe like 1 week here, 1 month here, forever in Los Angeles. And she's like, it was 60 minutes too. I could have been the next Diane Sawyer. And he asks her what's wrong with being Gale Weathers because he likes her. And she's like, you know, we tried, we're different. He says that is what you used to call our strength. She asks if he's there because of Jennifer, and he's like, not everything is about you. And of course, she's like, you know something, what do you know? He tells her, off the record, 2 months ago, the Woodsboro Police Department got a call from a woman who said she was with Stab 3. She wanted Sydney's file for research, but they refused to give it to her, and she wouldn't leave her name. A month later, the station gets broken into, and the file room is ransacked, which of course he had already went in and removed Sydney's file. So he thinks it's someone with the movie trying to get a hold of Sydney. So Jennifer beeps Dewey, he leaves to go be with her, Gail follows, and they go in. Jennifer's smoking, freaking out. Steven Stone, Jennifer's bodyguard, tells him there's been another murder and tells him about Sarah. Dewey then realizes they're dying in the order in which they die in Stab 3. So Gail asks who dies next, and of course finds out it's her. Dewey and Gail walk out, Jennifer jumps into Stone's arms, and he like is holding her almost bridal style, and it's such a ridiculous scene, but it's so fucking funny that it's one of my favorite, like, just random Parker Posey moments. Because let me tell you, Parker Posey is the saving grace. Like, my ranking as of now, because I have not seen the newest one yet, my ranking is 1-2, Parker Posey in Scream 3. Scream 4, a mile later, Scream 3. Because that's how much I love her in this damn movie. She's so good. And sometimes my ranking for 2 and 4 swap, because I really like 4. But we'll get into that. So Dewey goes into his trailer, which is on Jennifer's property. He grabs his gun and he tells Stone that he's going to go to the crime scene, stick with Jennifer, maybe search the grounds. Stone calls him Dewdrop and says he's the professional bodyguard, starts naming everyone that he's protected, and he's like, you're the hanger-oner, so you should take advice from me. At the crime scene, there's another Maureen Prescott photo. Gail asks if it's the same killer, and Kincaid shows Gail the photo and tells Dewey that there are 3 scripts and 3 different characters die next, and they don't know which one the killer read. Roman is now sitting with Jennifer and Dewey. He said he wanted to make a serious movie, and the studio said he could after he made a horror film, which is very much what happened to Wes Craven. He wanted to make the Music of the Heart film, but they told him he needed to do Scream 2, and then he could make his other movie. Roman says that he thinks he's the next target and shows them the decapitated statue that's in his office. Kincaid and Wallace tell Roman, you know, you didn't tell us that you talked to Sarah, darling. He's like, I didn't. The roommate's like, you called her. The roommate knows your voice. Security guard said that she said she was here to meet you. So Roman's like making serious eye contact with Dewey and Jennifer, and he's like, I didn't do it. She didn't talk to me. So they take him in, and Kincaid asks to borrow Dewey's cell phone. Jennifer then tells him to remind her to never sleep with Roman again. At Sydney's, she is at home working when a woman is on the phone saying that she killed someone. Sydney tells her that she needs to call the police. Her voice changes a bit and she's like, no, I'm supposed to call you. Sydney realizes that the call is on her home line, not her work line, and the voice tells her it's mother and to turn on the news. How in the fuck could this thing mimic Maureen Prescott, who's been dead for like 4 years? Like, this is brand new technology. Suspend disbelief for a second. Brand new technology. Are we to believe that Roman somehow found home movies or the brief times he recorded her when he was stalking her, somehow took her voice from that video and is able to then just talk like her, like normal? There's scenes later on where there's certain like vocal inflections that it's also somehow able to mimic, like laughs or scoffs or stutters, to where it doesn't sound generated. Like, I don't understand it. It's super weird. Like, even like on TikTok now, they have these voice things where you can do voiceovers, and they still say words weird. It doesn't sound like a real person. And so, like, the fact that it's 2022 and we still don't have this technology, but this was a big thing 22 years ago, just, it's so fucking stupid. And I think that if this had been taken out and they couldn't mimic voices, I might like this movie a little bit more. It changes back to Ghostface and he's like, you know, do you think this is over? Sydney grabs her guns, looking all through her house all scared. We cut to Jennifer's house again, and the rest of the Stab 3 cast is there. Tom's destroying his script, and they're saying it's like a rap party. It's through this scene that we find out that we would have had a Maureen murder flashback. And I'm honestly surprised they never tried to do that. That none of the other movies had a moment where they went to Maureen's death. Or if we had like a prequel scene. Angelina tells Tom to stop because he's scaring her. So she takes off outside. Jennifer and Dewey leave the room as Gail arrives. She rings the doorbell. No one answers. Gail sees Jennifer and Dewey, so she sneaks around the house to try to eavesdrop on their conversation. They're looking at a photo of Jennifer stylized like Gail, and he's saying it's a good picture. Stone catches her, brings her inside. They go off talking, and Gail tells him that the call didn't come from Rowan's phone, so he was let go. She asks how old he thinks Maureen is in these photos, and Gail says 2 years before she met Neil, she left Woodsboro, and no one knows why. Dewey looks at the photo and realizes the photo of Jennifer was taken at the same place. Outside, Stone's phone rings and it's Dewey asking where he is. He says that something has happened and he has to go to the police. Which at this moment, and we'll get into this more, but at this moment, having one killer, one of which just left the police station, seems illogical. You have to basically assume that Roman sees Stone outside and then calls him as Dewey, and he has to hope and pray that Dewey doesn't walk outside right when he's calling. So it makes sense if the other killer was also at the house and saw all this and could say, hey, we're good to go, we can start that call. But whatever, we'll get into it. Stone tells him that he doesn't take orders from him and he's checking out the trailer. Stone says that he's making sure there's not a killer inside waiting to off him like his little sister. Again, one of the few times anybody ever talks about Tatum and the fact that Dewey's sister fucking died. And of course, this is fake Dewey. And he's like, oh my god, I can't believe you said that. It makes me so angry. And then Ghostface pops out and stabs him in the back, hits him in the face with the frying pan a few times. We cut to Dewey, who says, you know, the real Dewey, saying that he's going to call Kincaid. And they walk out of the bedroom to see everyone in the house gone. Front door flies open. Jennifer comes in from outside scaring them. Then Tom comes out scaring them. They see Stone walk out across the doorway covered in blood. And he collapses with a knife in his back. Dewey sends everyone back inside when the power goes out. They go out a back door and the phone rings. It's the fax going off somehow. Even though the power's out, the fax still works. I don't understand how this worked. It makes no sense. So the fax is going off. It's sending script pages where the killer is basically rewriting the movie. So Dewey wants them to all go outside, but the pages say the killer's outside, so they don't want to go out there. Dewey's like, it's a trap. We need to go outside. The killer says with the pages that the killer is willing to give mercy to one. So they're all outside. Tom goes inside because he wants to find out who it is. And he gets his lighter because he can't see. And the page then says, the first who smells the gas. The house and Tom then explode. Gail, Jennifer, and Dewey go falling down the hill, and they kind of separate a little bit. Dewey goes down the hill a bit, finds Gail in front of a car. Ghostface jumps out, and Dewey shoots him and falls down the hill. Ghostface is now gone. He asks if she's okay, and she thanks him for saving her life. He's like, oh, it's a habit, and goes to kiss her because, you know, it's Dewey and Gail. When Jennifer comes over, freaking the fuck out, saying, you know, you didn't save me, like, you worked for me. She hits Dewey, and then Gail hits Jennifer.
My lawyer liked that.
Not as much as I did.
Angelina comes down the hill just walking, doesn't really look all that injured, maybe has a little bit of dirt on her knees, and she's screaming that Tom was in the house and asks if they're all safe. And of course, they're all, like, side-eyeing the fuck out of this girl, and they're like, safe from who? He then looks in the on the ground and sees a photo of Maureen, and on the back it says, I killed her. So at the station, Kincaid, Dewey, and Gail are talking. Gail's like, we know it was Billy and Stu who killed Maureen because they basically told Sydney how they did it. Kincaid's like, well, you said in your book once before that Sydney got it wrong. Maybe there's a third killer. Which, I think I mentioned, in Scream 2, there was supposed to be a shot of a ghost face in that bell tower to signify that there is a third killer. Had they left that in there, this could have wrapped around. But again, Kevin Williamson writing versus Aaron Kruger writing. Totally different. So Dewey tries to say he doesn't know where Sydney is and she wouldn't know about it. Kincaid's like, she would know more about her mom, which is completely inaccurate. Dewey's like, you ask Neil, who was married to her, and he didn't know anything. So then Kincaid's like, well, you need to tell me where she's at. Like, enough's enough. And Dewey tries calling her, leaves a voicemail, but then he turns to see her actually walking into the station. They hug. He asks her what she's doing there. She says she should ask herself what she was doing up there hiding out. And if you notice, she's still wearing Derek's letters around her neck. Dewey's like, I told you to stay safe. Sydney confirms that the killer called her, and at least here, she's not alone. Sydney and Gail awkwardly hug, which I always hate. And we'll see it again in 4. They have kind of a weird interaction, and I hate that. I wish they would have that warm reunion just once. Like, I'm hoping in 5, or Scream 2022, whatever the fuck we're calling this one, I hope that they have a great reunion where they're actually happy to see each other and there's not this animosity, because I hate pitting girls against girls just to do it, or women against women. Like, it's frustrating. Like, let them both be happy to see each other successful. Dewey says that the killer called Sydney.
What do you say?
Oh, you know, the usual small talk. Let's know how you've been, how you want to die.
They try to figure out how the killer got her phone number, and it's in Dewey's phone, so Gail asks who all used his phone. He's like, well, just Jennifer, and then he realizes Kincaid did too, who's like, wait a minute, I'm helping you. We're all in my office here. Sydney sees the photos of Maureen, and she asks Dewey why he didn't tell her, because, you know, this is her mom. He should have told her. And he tells her he was worried it was a trap to get her out of hiding. And Gail asks if she was an actress, which, of course, Sydney has no idea, but suddenly wants to see the places in these photos, which makes no sense. Like, what good is that gonna do? But whatever. So they all head to the studio when suddenly Martha Meeks comes out of a trailer. This is Randy's sister. She's brought a tape for them of Randy. He's saying he's hoping this tape will save them. If it's a sequel, same rules apply. But if all of a sudden you have a new backstory, then it is actually the concluding chapter of a trilogy. He says true trilogies are all about going back to the beginning.
So if it is a trilogy you are dealing with, here are some super trilogy rules. 1, you got a killer who's going to be superhuman. Stabbing him won't work. Shooting him won't work. Basically, in the 3rd one, you got to cryogenically freeze his head, decapitate him, or blow him up. 2, anyone, including the main character, can die. This means you, Sid. I'm sorry. It's the final chapter. It could be fucking Reservoir Dogs by the time this thing is through. 3, the past will come back to bite you in the ass. Whatever you think you know about the past, forget it. The past is not at rest. Any sins you think were committed in the past are about to break out and destroy you.
He's wearing the same clothes as the party scene in Scream 2, so I am a bit confused. The day of the party, he didn't think that the killings had anything to do with them, but he did that night once Cece died. And I can't tell if this shot is daylight, because it kind of looks like it's daylight, but it would make more sense if it's nighttime after the party. So they all say bye to Martha, and Gail says she has an idea and will catch up with them later. She asks them to find out where the other photos were taken. Gail goes to the archives, cannot get in. Jennifer sneaks up on her and saying she's gonna stick with her.
What the hell are you doing?
Being Gail Weathers. What the hell are you doing?
I am Gail Weathers.
Here's how I see it. I've got no house, no bodyguard, no movie, and I'm being stalked. Because someone was to kill me? No, because someone was to kill you. So now, starting now, I go where you go. That way, if someone was to kill me, I'll be with you. And since they really want to kill you, they won't kill me. They'll kill you. Make sense?
None.
You know, in the movies, I play you as being much smarter.
And as a sane person. For you, that must be quite a stretch.
Jennifer uses her key card and lets them into the building. They go downstairs and show Maureen's photo. We get a wonderful Carrie Fisher cameo. She plays Bianca Burnett. They make a comment about her looking like, but of course they don't say Carrie Fisher's name. She's like, no, no, I know. I was up for the part of Princess Leia, but the girl who slept with George Lucas got it. Gail offers her money to tell them more about Maureen, which of course, Jennifer's like, my Gail would get the story, and ends up sitting her ring down and saying it's worth a few $1,000. So Bianca tells them that if they're looking for Maureen Roberts, they won't find her, but they will find Arena Reynolds. There are film credits on the back, and they're all horror films from Milton's heyday. We cut to Sydney in the bathroom, where she hears something in a stall behind her. She looks under and sees someone climb on the toilet with what looks like the boots that the killer has worn in the past. She kicks the door open with pepper spray, and it's Angelina with a ghost face mask. She said she wanted to keep souvenirs because she may never get another shot in Hollywood. Angelina takes off to the set, and Sydney realizes that she left her hairbrush behind and goes to follow her. She goes on set and walks through to realize she's in a mock-up of Woodsboro. She walks into her old bedroom. We hear clips of her and Billy from the first movie. Sydney hears a door open and looks out the window. Her bedroom door closes and she turns around with her pepper spray ready. She opens the closet door and blocks it like she did with her real bedroom. She walks towards the window and we hear something tugging on the door of the bedroom. Ghostface breaks through the window and grabs her. Sydney takes off running, screaming for Dewey. The killer chases after her. She throws things down the stairs at him. She goes through a door and almost falls down into her bedroom. Because, of course, this is a set, so it's not going to be rigged up like a normal house would. The killer opens the door, and she is now hanging on the side of the set. So she pulls him down and throws him on her old bed. Sydney screams for Dewey and hears someone whispering and asking her to come in. We hear Maureen saying, "Mother will protect you from the boogeyman," and we see blood everywhere, realizing that this is what it looked like when Maureen was killed. A body bag is on the ground, and Sydney hears Dewey scream for her. She runs for the window, and when she turns back around, the body bag is standing up, and Maureen is asking for her to give Mommy a kiss. Sydney jumps out of the window and hits the ground. They turn the lights on, and Sydney tells him the killer was up there. So Wallace goes up there. He's like, "There's no one up here." They help Sydney out of the studio, and Wallace is questioning Angelina, who tells him about stealing or taking the masks. Sydney tells Kincaid the killer was in Woodsboro, and he tells her that's not Woodsboro. He takes Sydney to the police station, and Gail and Jennifer arrive to tell him about Maureen. In Milton's office, Roman is complaining, saying they killed his movie and they're now killing his cast. Dewey, Jennifer, and Gail arrive and ask about Rena Reynolds. Milton tells Roman to head to the house. It's his birthday and they're having a huge party for Roman. They ask Milton about Maureen.
She was a bit player in a couple of my movies. A nobody. So what does it matter?
Oh, come on. You have made millions off the story of her murder. You're obsessed with her and you're obsessed with her daughter!
All right, easy, Geraldo.
Milton says the studio came to him with Stab, and he realized who she was after they finished Stab 1. Gail asks why he didn't say anything with the murders, and Milton says that he would be a suspect. Gail asks what happened to Maureen while she was in Hollywood, and Milton tells her to let it go. Gail threatens to go to the press, and he's like, "It was the 70s. Everything was different. You know, I was well known for my parties. Rena knew what they were for. Women like her met men who could help them with their careers." And he says that nothing happened to her that she didn't invite one way or another, no matter what she said after. He says things got out of hand and maybe they took advantage of her. This is not the city for innocence, and no charges were brought up. He says Rena Reynolds wouldn't play by the rules to get ahead in Hollywood, and you either play the game or you go home. I, for one, am completely shocked that any of this shit was in the movie because of the Weinsteins and what Harvey Weinstein has done. It just goes to show you how untouchable he thought he was. And I love how they say it was different in the 70s. No, the same shit's going on. It was happening then. It probably somewhat still happens now. There are plenty of people that are protected in Hollywood. Thankfully, Me Too came about. Harvey Weinstein was exposed. At the station, Sydney asks Kincaid what he knows about trilogies, and he's like, "All bets are off." She asks if he requested the case because he's kind of flirting with her, asking her to call him Mark, and she sees the big file that he has about everything with the killings and her. And she tells him that she'll call him Mark once he catches the killer. He tells her that they typically assign the cases that are around the studios to him because he grew up here and knows his way around the studios. He tells her that she's done the right thing by being here and being with others, and he knows about being haunted by things. He asks her what she knew about her mother, and Sydney tells him that she thought she had the perfect mom and the perfect family. She tells him that she found out that her mom had a secret life, and when she thought she knew all about that, more secrets came out. She tells him that she doesn't know who her mother is, and he tells her that she knows who her mother was to her. He is heading back to the studio, and when Sydney asks him what his favorite movie is, he says his life, and of course she agrees. Jennifer wants to go look for more evidence, and Gail tells her they just need to go tell Kincaid everything. Dewey's phone rings, and it's Sydney saying that John Milton has called, saying he has something to tell her about her mom. Dewey tries to tell her it's not a good idea, and she says she'll have big-time LAPD protection with her, but she wants him there too. So they decide to head to the party, and when they get there, they ask Roman where she is, and Roman points at Angelina and is like, "Oh, she's right there." And Roman says, "You know, I would never invite Sydney here," and Gail's like, "Well, she's on her way." So Roman tells him about a screening room from the 70s where they would drink, do drugs, have sex, and all this. So Angelina wants to find it. Roman wants to go look for it. Tyson doesn't want to split up, but they all agree to go together. So Roman and Jennifer go in the basement to look, Tyson and Angelina go upstairs. In the basement, there's a ton of statues and props. Roman goes down, Jennifer doesn't want to go down into the basement, so she waits for him. She's like kind of yelling for him and he doesn't respond. Dewey and Gail look around for Sydney, and of course they can't find her. Gail tells him to call the number back, and they hear a ringing in the room. They find the Ghostface costume and of course the stupid voice changer. She picks it up and realizes it's programmed with all their voices. Gale and Dewey split up to get everyone back together. Dewey finds Tyson, but Angelina is gone. Gale goes downstairs to find Roman and Jennifer. She sees the casket that's like a prop and opens it up to find Roman stabbed with a knife. She checks his pulse. Yes, that's right. She checks his pulse and still decides that he's dead. Jennifer jumps out asking if he's dead. They go running for Dewey.
Which I'm questioning here, what did Jennifer actually see? Because theoretically there would have to be a second ghost face. Because who attacked Roman? Like, how did he get in the casket? Because she's right there hiding. What happened here? This part doesn't make sense unless there's a second killer.
Angelina jumps out. She's like, hey guys, I found a secret passageway. She's trying to pull them towards the passageway. But they're telling her, you know, Roman's dead. So Angelina freaks out and takes off running. And she said that she didn't fuck that pig Milton for this role just to die here. They hear Dewey yelling. They go for him. Angelina gets stabbed in the chest by Ghostface. Gale and Jennifer look down the stairs to see her being dragged away. They start talking to Dewey, trying to explain what's going on, when Ghostface runs up and punches Dewey in the face. He's sliced on the arm, and Tyson gets stabbed in the stomach. Tyson takes off running.
Oh, you motherfucker!
It's so funny. I love that line. Jennifer falls into the secret passageway. Ghostface ends up, like, pulling the rug out from under him, causing Tyson to do this crazy-ass flip, basically onto his neck. Ghostface then tosses him off the balcony. Jennifer takes off downstairs. Ghostface comes up behind her. She's trying to get out of the secret passageway, so then she tries like running up back away from him because he has found the other secret way in there. She finds these big windows and you can basically see the bed, and I'm assuming in a gross, like, this is one of the viewing rooms they're talking about, where like men would go have sex with women and other men would watch from these windows. It's just disgusting. Jennifer starts banging on the glass because Dewey and Gale are now in the room. But she can't get their attention because it's soundproof. So then Dewey starts noticing the glass and he starts to shoot it. Ghostface is coming after Jennifer. She's telling him to get back, stay away, and all this. And she starts yelling that she's the killer in stab three. Which, of course, we know she's supposed to die. So is she lying? Did she actually see the real script? Whatever. So he stabs her in the back. And as Dewey is shooting the glass out, he stabs her in the stomach. Dewey shoots the glass that she's leaning against and she falls out dead. Dewey and Gale take off trying to find anybody else when Ghostface sneaks up on Gale and tries to stab her. She basically kicks the wall until they fall down the stairs. Dewey finds Tyson's dead body. Gale tries yelling for Dewey, but Ghostface is quasi-knocked out downstairs, so she's not trying to wake him up. Gale calls his cell to tell him where she is, and before he opens the door, he's like, is it really you? She tells him that it is her, and he asks, you know, don't you think that's what the killer would say? She tells him that he's out cold to the bottom of the stairs. But when he comes to trying, but then Ghostface comes to and tries to stab her. Dewey opens the door to shoot him, but he's out of bullets. Ghostface then throws the knife at Dewey, causing it to basically fly and flip, causing the butt of it to hit his forehead, and he falls down the stairs. We cut to Sydney at the station. She sees Kincaid's file for her. When her phone rings, and it's her own voice echoing back to her. Ghostface is on the line. We hear Dewey and Gale yelling. Sydney goes to the police and he tells her not to say anything. She closes herself in Kincaid's office. Ghostface says it's hard being her friend because her friends die. And he tells her that if she comes there, they'll survive. And he asks if she wants to know who killed her mother. He tells her that, you know, she would be so happy to know that we're together. Sydney takes the keys from the desk and looks at the drawers to find a gun. She leaves and heads to Milton's. She sees Tyson's body on the ground and her phone rings. Ghostface has her use a metal detector, and the gun that's strapped to her leg is exposed, so she has to throw it in the pool. He wants her to come inside, and she refuses until she sees Dewey and Gale tied up just inside. So she goes to untie them when Ghostface comes in and smacks her across the face. She falls to the ground, he gets the knife out. She grabs her other gun from her pant leg and shoots him multiple times in the chest. Dewey cheers, she goes to untie them, and Gale realizes that Ghostface is gone. So Sydney goes to try to find him when Kincaid suddenly comes out with his gun drawn. He said he figured that it was the third act celebration and that he should check it out, which they'll reference in Scream 4 as the stab formula. Sydney asks where Wallace is, and Kincaid puts his gun away and asks her to do the same. Ghostface shows up behind Sydney, and Kincaid kind of throws her out of the way. She hits her head on the chair and is quasi-knocked out. Kincaid gets stabbed. Sydney comes to, gets the gun. Kincaid is slammed against the fireplace, knocking him out. Sydney goes to shoot and misses. She's out of bullets, and she tells him, you know, if you want me, come get me. She runs to the house, locks herself in an office. She notices lights underneath the bookshelf and starts pulling to open a secret door. She goes in, locks herself in the room, but suddenly starts to hear Maureen's voice. She walks further into the room, and it's the secret viewing room they were looking for. Maureen is on the screen getting ready, and there's a voice asking Sydney if she's missed her. The body bag comes out walking towards her. The voice has changed to Ghostface, and he uses a remote to lock all the doors where she can't get out. Ghostface tells her that it's time to come to terms with him and Mother. He shows that he was wearing a bulletproof vest, and he tells Sydney he looked for his mom, an actress named Rena Reynolds, and he tried to find her his whole life. 4 years ago, he tracked her down, assuming she'd welcome him with open arms, but she said she had a new life and a new family. He removes the mask. We see that it is Roman, who Sydney has never met. So, of course, she's like, who the fuck are you? Which is interesting for the Scream 5 tagline for it to be, it's always someone you know. Because yes, Billy and Stu, yes, she knew Mrs. Loomis, yes, she knew Mickey. Roman, she did not know. And also, she didn't know Charlie either. Spoilers for Scream 4, but whatever. She didn't know Charlie either. So, is it always someone you know? Meh. Especially with this one, it's definitely not someone you always know. But anyways, Roman says the Marine slammed the door in his face, saying that he was Rena's child and Rena was dead. So he watched her. He stayed in town for a while and he made a home movie. We see clips of Maureen with Cotton. We see clips of Maureen with Billy's father. He says that Billy didn't like seeing his daddy in his movies. So once he supplied the motivation, all he needed were pointers. Have a partner to sell out in case you get caught. Find someone to frame. It was like he was making a movie. Then we cut to Dewey and Gale and are trying to get out of their ties. They're checking on Kincaid. He gives Dewey his gun. Dewey and Gale get out of their ties. They check on Kincaid, whose like nose is all busted up. He gives Dewey his gun, and Sydney says, we cut back to Sydney, and she says, Roman got what he wanted, villain and hero face to face. Now the villain dies. He's like, oh yeah, sure, but I'm not the villain, you are. He pulls Milton out of a closet, who's all bound up and gagged like Neil was, saying, you know, what he did to Rena, messed her up, fucked her three ways from Sunday, and he's the cause of all of this. Roman asks if she hates him, and she's like, no, because of course she has no idea who the fuck he is. Roman pulls out a tape player, and in Sydney's voice it says, I know who you are and what happened to my mother, and I'm going to make you pay. And Roman says that this will be on his machine next to his mutilated corpse. He takes the tape off of Milton's face. Milton's like, I'll make whatever you want happen, any picture, name your budget, script approval, final cut. Roman says he has final cut, and then slashes his throat, throwing him on the ground. Roman says she did it, she even killed her own friends. He tells her she just finally snapped, and that Roman gets to be the sole survivor. You know, it's for the mother he never had, the family, the fame, and everything that she had that should have been his. She tells him that she's heard this shit before, and she's like, you know why you kill people? It's because you choose to, and there's no one else to blame. She tells him to take responsibility, and he charges at her, but she blocks his knife with a candlestick. She goes to hit him with it, and he blocks her and chases after her. Dewey and Gale keep trying to get in the room, while Sydney and Roman basically go back and forth fighting. He's punching, he's kicking, and he tries choking her when Dewey sticks some little metal piece into the outlet, causing the power to go out. Roman takes off to try to look for them. Kincaid sneaks in with a gun. He sees Sydney on the ground, and she raises up slightly, but Roman hits Kincaid with a shelf, knocking him down, so she lays back down. Roman starts looking for his gun when Sydney gets his attention, asking if he lost something holding the knife. He turns around saying that he found something and shoots her in the stomach. He shoots her again in the chest and then goes to take off after Dewey and Gale. He turns around and sees that Sydney is now gone. So Roman starts looking for her. We see her hand reach up and grab a container of like pointy little bar tools. His back is to the bar. He tries to call her on the phone, but she's faster than that. So she actually calls him. His phone rings, and with that distraction, she stabs him in the back with an ice pick. Now, if you remember in the first Scream, I mentioned that she has a nasty little habit of actually hurting the Ghostface actors, okay? Scream 2, her and Laurie Metcalf knocked heads really bad during their big fight scene, and in this movie, she misses the pad and ends up stabbing Scott Foley with a retractable ice pick. So Sydney climbs over the bar, and he's like, no, I shot you. And she shows him her bulletproof vest, saying that they obviously think alike. He says, you know, mother's dead. There's nothing we can do about that. He's still got to make his movie. She stabs him in the chest. Dewey and Gale finally get in and see that the killer is Roman. Sydney holds his hand as he dies, and Dewey tells her to be careful because Randy said the killer's always superhuman. Sydney's like, he's not superhuman, not even a bit, and goes to walk away, which, of course, Roman stands up screaming with the knife, going to stab her. Dewey just keeps shooting him in the chest, even though nothing's happening, he's still coming. So Sydney starts screaming head, and finally he realizes to shoot him in the fucking head. So he's dead. We cut to Sydney's house where she's outside walking Cherokee. Dewey has Gail's book and he's asking her to sign it. She's like, you hate that book. Like, I'm done with that kind of reporting. He asks her to sign it for him. So she opens the book and there is actually a ring where he has cut out a little space for this ring. He says he knows it'll never work. She knows it'll never work. But he's asking her to see if they're wrong. She tells him that he's a brave man and he says he's really scared. She kisses him and puts on the ring. Sydney and Cherokee come up the driveway. She leaves the gate open. They go all inside. Sydney doesn't set the alarm. Kincaid is also there for movie night. The front door opens on its own and she leaves it open. But that's the movie. So now to get into the crazy pre-production mess, because it is fucking bananas. So when Scream 3 started, everyone was busier and busier. Kevin Williamson had movies and TV shows that were requiring his focus. There was an original script where Stu actually survives and is in jail. I have a clip from a HorrorCon where Matthew Lillard's asked about it.
So I was approached to do Scream 3. The idea of Scream 3 was that Stu was running a gang of high school students to commit a mass murder at a high school. And about a month before we started production, Columbine High School happened. And in the name of decency, they changed the script. They scrapped the entire thing. So at the 11th hour, they threw it away and went a different way. So what you saw was terrible because people were scrambling to make something. Because what they do is they put a date in the book to make a movie 2 years down the road. And they have to deliver that movie.
The idea for Scream 3 eventually turned into a TV show by Kevin Williamson called The Following. I loved the first season of The Following. And the original ending for his script of Scream 3, which was then moved to The Following, was that the end was going to be this big party scene where there was like massive people dying, but then suddenly they would all raise up and they were all in on it. And it was all this big thing with Stu leading them from jail. And I just would have loved to have seen how this turned out, but I get why they didn't do it. So then the next script that he made was all set in Woodsboro, Stab 3 still getting made, but the killer is trying to get Sydney into Woodsboro because in the original opening, Sydney, her and a friend are together and they think they're being attacked and she kills the person that she believes is trying to attack them, but it's just a fan. She goes into hiding. So now they have to start all over again, and it's about a month before filming starts. So Dimension ends up wanting to go in a whole different direction. Bob Weinstein is going to sue Kevin Williamson because he had the rights to Scream 3, but Kevin agreed to do a different movie, which ended up being Cursed, which is appropriately named because that movie has one hell of a production. Maybe we'll go over it in a future episode. We'll see. Anyway, so Aaron Kruger gets brought in, and I credit him with destroying Scream 3. Bob Weinstein called him saying they didn't have a script and they had to start shooting in 6 weeks. And Wes even praises Aaron for being able to go into a room and come out with many, many pages, but it's like, hello, that does not mean those are good pages. Aaron had to work with Wes and even the actors to try to find their voice for the characters because he wasn't able to mimic Kevin's voice. Aaron had written Sydney to be very Sarah Connor-esque, like in The Terminator, and Wes had to intervene and bring the characters back to their roots. Bob Weinstein eventually pulled Aaron Kruger away, so they had to bring in Latique Calagrias, and she basically helped finish out the parts and flesh everything out. The big focus was to lean more towards comedy, and production even tried to request a completely bloodless, no-violent horror film. And Wes was like, no, be serious. We're either going to make a Scream movie or we're just going to call this something else. But the studio refused to budge on the killers being teenagers. Neve Campbell was honestly very hesitant about coming back to Scream 3 because she didn't want that moniker of Scream Queen and being typecast for being in horror movies. She was filming Drowning Mona, Party of Five, and now Scream 3, so she only wanted to be there for about 20 days. And because of that, at one point, Kevin Williamson, when he was still writing, had three plans. A Sydney plan, a plan without Sydney, and a plan that wouldn't really rely on her so they could still make the movie and involve her. They ended up deciding to completely move away from Woodsboro and have Hollywood be the setting and the exact cause of Scream 3. This time, the killer's not blaming the movies, but blaming Hollywood. So I mentioned earlier there was that script that you can find online. We're gonna go over it now. You can find this on HelloSydney.com. you can tell that the characters aren't themselves. I'm not going to go into all the dialogue because it's poor. So we start off, the opening is with actually Ben Damon, who is complaining to his agent Kathy about getting a cameo in Stab 3. He's on his way to the Stab 2 premiere where his girlfriend has a bit part. He's stuck in traffic, so he decides he's going to call a phone sex line when suddenly he gets a call from Ghostface. And Ghostface is like, I'm at the premiere. He does movie trivia. He asks who the girlfriend's playing. She's playing Cece. He's like, great, now part two. You have to meet me here. So he has a meeting with the Hollywood Sun. And when Ben gets there, he sees that Christina's basically hollowed out like Casey Becker and is hanging from the H of the Hollywood Sun. And then he gets killed there as well. So they're our opening kill. Gail is actually, instead of just doing some weird like speech thing for a college, she's actually doing her show Total Entertainment, where she's interviewing Roman. While she's interviewing him, the audience is dressed up like Ghostface, but Gail notices there's another Ghostface like up near the top who's like miming slashing someone's throat. So you kind of get the hint right away about two killers, which up until this movie was par for the course. We know there's two killers. Kincaid goes to talk to Gail immediately about the murders, but instead of photos of Maureen, there are news clippings left of the crime scene. We have a scene of Kincaid talking to Milton, and he talks about, you know, how much he loves the Stab movies. Milton's like, oh, you got a great face for acting. And he's like, I'm very dedicated to my work, but I do, like, acting lessons on the side. And it's just more stuff to make him a red herring, which I'm glad they cut out. Wallace at one point was also a killer, not in this script, but in a later draft, he was a killer, so that's why there's kind of weird moments with him too. The ghost Maureen stuff's in the script, and there's even a line about how Sydney has scars on her wrist from past suicide attempts, and we don't really get to see Sydney working. We jump straight into Sydney getting a call from fake Maureen, and, you know, wanting her to be in Hollywood. And Ghostface is telling her, you know, I've got my eyes set on Dewey, so if you want to save him, you need to come here. Sarah's death is basically the same, except for like a weird throwaway line about getting stabbed in the Adam's apple. And I can't tell if it's just Aaron Kruger being stupid and not realizing that women don't have Adam's apples, or if he's being slightly transphobic here. Also, just not a good look. And he name checks Arlington Street, which is a play on Arlington Road, which is a film that he wrote that he, I guess, had some sort of a claim for. He name checks it multiple times in the movie. And it's just, like, kind of sad. Like, if that's your claim to fame, you shouldn't throw it in this movie over and over again. Especially because you did so terrible, but whatever. The rap party at Jennifer's is a little different. Tom tries hitting on Angelina. She takes off. Tom goes after her. Wanders into the guest house that Dewey's living in. He sees her, Angelina, in a pool of blood. But then Ghostface attacks him and kills Tom. Someone knocks on the main door of the house. They're arguing, you know, would the killer knock? Dewey goes to open it. And then the power goes out. Ghostface calls Jennifer's cell and then comes out to attack them. Dewey shoots him, but Ghostface is obviously wearing a bulletproof vest, so he still tries to attack them with a knife. Jennifer trips on something when she tries to attack Ghostface, and they all run out the door as he lights a trail of gas, causing the house to explode. At the station, they mention they can't find Angelina's body, and we see news clippings and a photo of Maureen were found. This is a photo of her and Cotton, and they're like, no, he has an alibi. He's in Australia doing 100% Cotton. Sydney wants to see the studio where all this is happening, which in this makes even less sense because there's no photo. So, like, she just wants to go to the studio for no reason versus just staying with everybody else. They go to the trailers where Karen Kolchek shows up with a video of Randy, not his sister. Randy's tape is basically the same, except there's an extra rule about not going off alone. The bathroom scene where Sydney sees two Ghostface, the bathroom scene's a little different, and Sydney actually sees two Ghostface showing up. And Sydney, who carries a knife with her, manages to stab one of them in the shoulder. Gail comes back with Jennifer, and they talk to Sydney and Dewey about how for Gail's book, she had done research on Maureen, and there were years of her life where she disappeared, and it turns out she was an actress. I wish they would have left this in. Like, Gail kind of explains that she knows that there's a time frame that's missing, but, like, it's not explained that Gail would have done all this research for her books. Like, Gail would know that there's a blind spot in Maureen's history. And Wallace is actually waiting for backup, not going into the bathroom, because this is all kind of happening at the same time, because he doesn't carry bullets in his gun. And so there's, again, more foreshadowing for him as well. There's a John Milton Ghostface scene where he's attacked and killed in an elevator. Dewey and Gale break into Milton's office later on. They find paternity test results. Before we can find out who his kid is, Ghostface attacks. Dewey gets knocked out with the butt of the knife again, which was stupid the first time. It's stupid this time. Gale finds Milton's body, runs out of the studio, finds Kincaid. Ghostface is right behind her and kills Kincaid. Ghostface calls Sydney, sends her to the back lot of the studio. She was at the police station waiting. She goes on set, goes through Faux Woodsboro, and that's basically the movie, the big end, is at the studio and on the lots. So Ghostface calls her as Dewey because the voice changer's still in this movie. Sydney finds Gale in the Prescott house. They hide in Maureen's room. Ghostface tries to break the door down. Sydney shoots him through the door. Body bag raises up, and it's another Ghostface. We got more running. Dewey comes to, but is stabbed by a thrown knife. When suddenly Angelina appears, Roman reveals himself, and we find out that Angelina is actually Angie Crick from Woodsboro, and her and Roman have been together since he came to Woodsboro to find Maureen. Roman makes a comment about how Angelina is Sydney, and so every time he sleeps with her, it's like sleeping with Sydney, which is, of course, a really gross line. He admits Milton's his father. He starts to stab himself like Billy and Stu. Gale starts fighting Angelina while Roman and Sydney face off. And then suddenly a ghost face comes out and stabs Roman in the chest, but it's Dewey who takes off the mask like Sydney did in Scream 1. Gale yells about the stardom she never had, which makes zero fucking sense, and then throws the TV down onto Angelina's face, killing her like Stu's death. Dewey tells him to watch out because the killer is superhuman. Angelina raises up, Sydney shoots her in the head, and also shoots Roman just in case. And that's the end of that script. Very, very similar to the original Scream script, which that was also something else that happened to kind of get the voices down and the writing style down. Aaron Kruger read the original scripts that Kevin wrote. He watched the original films, and in the original script basically mimicked the original ending. So what can you do? Shows how talented of a writer he's not. So casting for this movie was insane because of all the rewrites and all the mess. Eventually the opening changed to Cotton and his girlfriend, but even that had multiple different versions filmed. And the fact that Cotton had like his 100% Cotton talk show was actually a joke from the editors on Scream 2. They were joking that he would get some sort of trashy talk show, and that fact was added to this movie. Heather Maserato was brought in to be Martha Meeks. Originally, that part was filmed with a contortionist who would do all these weird contortions while Randy is doing his bit, and they cut that out. Feruza Balk was brought in consideration for Martha. Scott Foley ended up auditioning for Roman and had like a nice side and an evil side to use with his scenes. Benicio del Toro was considered for Roman. They also kept the idea of an actress playing Gale from Kevin's original treatment. They cast Parker Posey. Terry Hatcher, Selma Blair, and Taya Leone were all up for this part, but, you know, Posey Parker won and she was the best girl for the job. During the fight scene, Parker Posey says that Courtney Cox actually did hit her in the face, which is hilarious. Emily Mortimer was cast as Angelina, the girl who wins the part of Sydney and Stab. She ended up not having the right permit to work in the U.S., and they had to fly her out to Vancouver so they could get the correct permit just as production started. They had considered having Tori Spelling brought back, as well as Dwayne Martin, who played Joel, but that didn't pan out. Patrick Dempsey was hired the day before he started filming without much of a script. David Boreanaz was also in consideration for Mark Kincaid. Liv Tyler, Jennifer Connelly, Alicia Silverstone, Kate Winslet, who was just coming off of Titanic fame, Shannon Doherty, Charisma Carpenter, Rachel True, Kerry Russell, Alyssa Milano, and Denise Richards were all considered for the part of Christine Hamilton, which ended up going to Kelly Rutherford. Kate Hudson was actually announced as joining the cast as either Christine or Sarah Darling and was later replaced. Tara Reid, Monica Arnold, Ali Larder were all considered for Sarah Darling, but she was eventually played by Jenny McCarthy. Paul Walker, Josh Hartnett, James Vanderbeek, Jonathan Jackson, Glenn Quinn, Ethan Erickson, and Charlie O'Connell were all considered for the part of Tom Prince, who was played by Mark Kessler. The actor slash stuntman who played Ghostface was originally cast to be David Arquette's double, but when he got to his dressing room, all he found was the Ghostface costume. He says that most of the cast was more than willing to be physical, and it made his job much easier. During the movie, I talked about how there were some moments where it felt like you had to have a second killer. Angelina was going to be one of those killers. Like I said earlier, also Wallace was. Scott Foley said that he knew about halfway through filming he was going to be the killer, mainly because it was told to him. Someone at Craft Services was like, oh, did you hear? And telling him he's going to be the killer. And Scott Foley is on record in the Still Screaming documentary saying that he's not sure that him being the killer and like Sydney's long lost brother makes sense. And he even asked, you know, is this something that Kevin would have done? In January of 2000, 3 months after principal photography was completed and a month before the film came out, they had to go back and reshoot the ending because they found it to be inadequate. And of course, yet again, Wes Craven had issues with the MPAA. This time it was much worse than fighting for Scream 1, and he even considered leaving the horror genre because of it. Scream 3, of course, did not perform as well, but it still made over $160 million. So, like, did it bomb? No, of course not. But there is a huge quality gap between 1 and 2 and 3. A few have tried to say that it's the 2-year gap between films. I disagree with that completely. It is the fact that this movie is not as good. The changing of the time is a huge point. Columbine caused a lot of people to start looking at violence in movies, TV, music, and video games. Not to mention horror itself was rapidly changing. Every movie's trying to mimic Scream, and then you have Scream 3, which doesn't even match itself. It's more of a parody at times. Then you have found footage and reality TV becoming the next big thing. And you gotta think, a year later, 9/11 happens. And just a year later was 9/11, which brought on a whole new subgenre of horror with torture porn. Everything's changing, and this was right on the cusp of that. We did have a few cameos in this one. Beth Toussaint's voice is in the opening scene. Roger Corman, who's a B-horror producer, is a Sunrise Studio exec. I mentioned Wes Craven was a tourist. Lisa Beach is the casting director. She's the tour guide. Jay and Silent Bob portray themselves. Nancy O'Dell is an Entertainment Tonight host. Carrie Fisher plays an actress that looks like Carrie Fisher. And Lynn McRee came back as Maureen Prescott. I do want to go over the deaths as well. Of course, all of them are technically Roman, but sometimes they don't make sense because at one point the script had two killers while they were filming, and you can see where there's kind of weird spots. So Christine, Hamilton, Cotton Weary, those are both Roman. Sarah Darling, Roman. Sydney Cole, also Roman, but how did he get her number? Dewey has Sydney's phone number in his phone. His phone's at Jennifer's. The rap party's at Jennifer's. So unless Roman took the phone from Kincaid when he borrowed it and then got the number, this makes no sense, which is why Angelina could have gotten it from Dewey's phone at the rap party. Steven Stone was killed by Roman. However, Angelina could be setting up everything in the kitchen. Roman would cut the power and send the faxes. So it makes sense how he's able to do all this shit right here if there was a second killer. Tom Prince is killed by Roman. Gail is attacked by Roman. Sydney's attack in Woodsboro is Roman, but this was written with two killers, so it could have been either one, because that would explain how you've got one person tugging on the door and one person pulling her out the window. Angelina Tyler's death is obviously Roman, but fun fact, in one of the box sets, they have like an RIP section where they list everyone that's been killed in these movies, and Angelina's not listed, so either that's just a huge error, or there's more weird shit on the horizon. Jennifer Jolie is killed by Roman, John Milton is killed by Roman, and of course Roman himself is killed by Dewey. Dewey gets his first kill on the list, because it's been Sydney and Gail killing everybody. So what do you think? Do you hate Scream 3? Do you like Scream 3? Let me know all your thoughts. You can find me all over social media. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at TerrorTPod. We're on the Facebook group. We have TerrorT there. You'll catch horror news, updates, podcast news, all kinds of fun stuff. So come join us over there. If you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to the podcast. And if you really like it, leave me a 5-star review. Again, I'm your host, Tara, and this has been TerrorT.